he said. They have touched our hearts, and I'm sure the hearts of millions of Americans who saw that welcoming on television. Kissinger turned to Eagleburger and Scowcroft. It's too bad that such crowds can't be turned out in the United States, he said. The three men laughed. The next day, June 14th, the president helicoptered to Giza and, defying his doctors again, toured the Great Pyramids on foot with Sadat. Returning to Cairo, the two leaders announced a joint agreement for economic cooperation, including a United States pledge to sell nuclear reactors and fuel to Egypt. As a surprise token of his friendship, Nixon gave Sadat the $2 million helicopter in which they had flown. Members of the presidential party joked to the pilot that he would be the president's next state gift. On the motorcade to the airport, the president emerged from his Lincoln convertible, waded into the masses, and was mobbed. Secret Service agents, incredulous at his recklessness, flailed at the faceless bodies until they could establish a cordon around him. Then, as gently as possible, they pushed him back into the car and whisked him away. Relieved at the close call, the security men asked each other why Haig didn't intervene. It was the chief of staff's job. Haldeman had sometimes let the president take small risks in motorcades and crowds, but never anything like this. What was wrong? Couldn't Haig talk sense to the president? But Nixon continued to chart his own course, ordering that whatever free time his schedule called for be devoted to more public appearances, particularly if they might involve large crowds. That afternoon, after crossing the Red Sea by plane to Saudi Arabia, he rode from the airport to Jeddah in King Faisal's Rolls-Royce, the Secret Service, which always prefers that a president use his own limousine with an agent at the wheel, was horrified. The president seemed to be doing everything he could to make his protection more difficult. The following morning, the president refused to be driven in anybody's car. In spite of the pain in his leg, he insisted on making the 5-minute walk across the Alhambra Palace grounds to his meeting with the king. At the departure ceremony that afternoon, Faisal's farewell message went beyond pro forma tribute paying. What is very important is that our friends in the United States of America be themselves wise enough to stand behind you, to rally around you, Mr. President, in your noble efforts, almost unprecedented in the history of mankind, the efforts aiming at securing peace and justice in the world. And anybody who stands against you, Mr. President, in the United States of America, or outside the United States of America, or stands against us, your friends in this part of the world, obviously has one aim in mind, namely that of splintering the world, the bringing on of mischief. The president flew east once more, to Damascus, Syria. Again, he was ignoring the advice of those responsible for his safety. They had been insistent that this part of the trip be canceled. Syria had broken off relations with the United States in 1967. The absence of diplomatic facilities made it impossible to secure adequate intelligence about terrorist activities. The extraordinary number of Palestinian refugees was gravely worrisome to the Secret Service. Worse, the limited American intelligence available was skeptical of President Assad's ability to control either the government or the population of revolutionary Syria. 30 minutes out of Damascus, the president's plane was cruising at 15,000 feet. George Julwan, Haig's assistant, noticed two Russian-built MiG jets approaching on the left. Look, he shouted. We've got fighter escorts. Somebody else pointed out two more jets closing from the right. Brent Scowcroft knew that the advance team always prohibited any such escort. Wouldn't this be a hell of an ending, he said. Henkel got up to investigate. As he turned, the plane suddenly began to nosedive and went into a series of rolls. Henkel was thrown across the aisle into the seat next to Scowcroft. He looked up at Scowcroft's soft gray eyes. They were bulging like two silver dollars. Colonel Ralph Albertazzi, the president's pilot, took the giant jet through a series of evasive turns and steep banks for 7 minutes while he sought assurance that the four Syrian aircraft were friendly. Finally convinced, Albertazzi resumed his approach pattern and landed. As the plane taxied to a halt, Syrian security men were still confiscating handsomely printed leaflets distributed that morning throughout the low-income districts of Damascus. Was all the war all the blood that was shed under American bombs, all the dead we suffered, so that Nixon and the prophet of imperialism, Kissinger, could visit Damascus and give us $100 million? The 28-mile route to the city was lined with soldiers armed with Russian-made AK-47 automatic rifles. As the crowds grew thicker, the president insisted that the roof of the limousine be opened. He stood, smiling and waving. The spectators were subdued for the most part, more curious than enthusiastic. "Revolutionary Damascus welcomes President Nixon," the sign said. His meeting with Assad was instructive. As they talked, Assad's young son turned to his father and said, "Isn't Nixon the one you said on TV is a foreign devil and the friend of the Jews? Now you are having him here. Why?" Assad said to Nixon, "That's my son. That's also my people. So you see my problems." On the afternoon of Sunday, June 16th, the two leaders announced the resumption of diplomatic relations between their countries. Then the president jetted off to Israel to promise the Israelis the same nuclear power capability he had offered Egypt. 19,000 armed troops and security agents provided the toughest security ever afforded a foreign visitor. The road to Jerusalem was lined with workers and children who had been given the day off. Their placards proclaimed mixed feelings. "Blessed be your welcome." "Don't sell us out." "You can't run from justice." And "Welcome, President Ford." After a visit to Jordan on June 17th, the president headed for home. Aboard Air Force One, he emerged from his cabin in a red plaid sports coat and strolled back to the staff section, stopping to talk with everyone except the members of the press pool. He was tanned, but he looked tired. In 9 days, he had traveled 14,775 miles and had met with 7 heads of state. Reaching speechwriter Dave Gergen, he lingered. "I used a lot of your stuff," he said. "Not all of it, of course. You understand." Gergen nodded. "Now that you've had this experience, would you like to be an ambassador?" Nixon asked. Gergen, 33 years old, didn't know what to say. The idea was preposterous. The president asked him if he spoke French. "Not very well." "Then I'll have to send you to Iraq," Nixon said. The president's blue and white helicopter landed on the South Lawn at 4:29 p.m., Wednesday, June 19th. Vice President Ford, members of the cabinet, 200 teenage Republicans, and most of the White House staff were waiting. They waved small American flags and chanted, "Two more years! Two more years!" Welcoming the president home, Ford quoted an Arabic saying, "May Allah make the end better than the beginning." Chapter 17. June 21st was the Nixon's 34th wedding anniversary. That day, the president's former special counsel, Charles W. Colson, was sentenced to a 1-to-3-year term in the federal penitentiary. Reading from a prepared statement, Colson implicated the president in his crime. Nixon had, "on numerous occasions, urged me to disseminate damaging information about Daniel Ellsberg," the same act for which Colson was going to jail. "He was convinced that the president believed he was acting in the national interest," Colson added. Nixon was at Camp David for 3 days' rest and to prepare for his trip to Russia. Though the swelling in his leg had eased somewhat, his doctors pleaded with him to postpone the trip. He refused. The press, which had finally learned of his illness, was told that he had suffered a mild case of phlebitis on the last journey, but that it had abated. The crew of Air Force One had barely time to apply a coat of turtle wax to the fuselage before the president flew away from Watergate again, bound for Brussels and then the Soviet Union. He crossed the Atlantic with his left leg elevated to reduce the pain. He was looking forward to his meeting with Brezhnev. The Secretary General of the Communist Party was his friend. The 36 hours in Belgium were given over largely to ceremonial meetings, called to assure America's NATO allies that the president would make no agreements with the Soviet Union until they had been consulted. At Vnukovo Airport, Secretary Brezhnev bounded across the tarmac to greet Nixon, leaving his translator behind for the moment. As they drove to the Kremlin in Brezhnev's black Zeal limousine, They talked animatedly, pausing to wave to respectful Muscovites gathered at prearranged points along the route. Many of the spectators held small Soviet and American flags. The president was genuinely fond of his Soviet colleague. Brutal politician though he might be, Brezhnev could also be jovial, sentimental, gregarious, and a marvelous raconteur. He had the elemental qualities of the crude, rough-talking, heavy-drinking comrade, Kissinger observed in a private moment, qualities that Nixon himself lacked, but was drawn to. Regardless of the warm greeting, the president knew he could expect only so much from Brezhnev. The Soviet press had largely ignored Watergate. When the matter was referred to, it was portrayed as a plot to destroy détente. But the Kremlin understood the precarious nature of Nixon's position. KGB agents stationed in Washington under journalistic cover had been canvassing American politicians and reporters about the likelihood of the president's finishing his term. Pointedly, Soviet officials told Western journalists that they expected no dramatic results from the Moscow summit conference. Rather, they hoped to traditionalize the principle of top-level meetings, no matter who was the president. The president had his usual present for Brezhnev, an American automobile for the secretary's extensive collection. Their first two summits in 1972 and 1973 had yielded two $10,000 models, a Cadillac limousine and a Lincoln Continental. This time, it was a $5,578 Chevrolet Monte Carlo, not very impressive in a garage that already housed a Citroen Maserati Speedster, Rolls-Royce and Mercedes sedans, and Brezhnev's favorite, a new Mercedes 300 SL Roadster. But Brezhnev had learned that the Monte Carlo was named Car of the Year by Motor Trend magazine, and he had let it be known that he would like one. The Nixon-Brezhnev summit of 1972 had resulted in a treaty limiting each country's defensive and offensive nuclear missile systems, the top jewel in the crown of the administration's foreign policy agreements. Their summit in 1973 had kept John Dean on ice for a week as the Senate Watergate Committee suspended its hearings in deference to Brezhnev's visit to the United States. Now, the 1974 summit was suspect in Congress, where fears were widespread that the president might somehow sell out in desperation to get an arms limitation agreement which would improve his public standing. Nixon and Kissinger were of one mind in believing that limiting the expansion of nuclear weapon systems and maintaining parity in the balance of nuclear terror were the key to a successful détente with the Soviet Union. And, in their grand strategy, the American-Soviet relationship was the key to world peace. United States' influence in every area of the world was predicated on a delicate, cooperative relationship with the Russians. Every major diplomatic move was viewed in relation to the prospective Soviet reaction. The ability of the United States to promote peace in the Middle East, or to fight in Vietnam, hinged on at least tacit acceptance by the Russians. Because so much was premised on the balance of nuclear force, no treaty was regarded as more important by Nixon or Kissinger than a permanent strategic arms limitation, SALT, agreement. The president had often confided to Kissinger his most telling reason for slowing down the nuclear arms race. He feared that the United States would lose it. Continued military competition was too expensive. The country might not be able to sustain the costs of a prolonged Cold War. America, the president felt, was too likely to buckle under the pressure. Besides the economic weakness of the country, Nixon perceived a weakness of will. Too many of the same political critics who were pushing him to the wall on Watergate would not support a tough posture toward the Russians, he said. The president and Kissinger regarded the stakes in the 1974 summit as especially high. If they offered the kind of tough proposal they preferred, its rejection would almost inevitably escalate the arms race. If they offered a less ambitious proposal, which the Soviets were more likely to accept, Nixon would be accused by critics of selling out for a cheap Watergate-motivated deal. Both Kissinger and the president had decided to lean in the direction of making the Soviets a more palatable offer and taking a chance with the critics at home. They were in agreement that their proposal served American interests well. But Kissinger calculated that the prospects of any satisfactory agreement were substantially reduced by Watergate. The Soviets were likely to test how far the president would bend. Kissinger was less than absolute in his confidence that Nixon could withstand the pressure. His concern went beyond the question of Nixon's will, however. The president had not done his homework, and he seemed distracted. Unless he mastered his briefing book in a matter of hours, Kissinger feared, Nixon would never be able to grasp the essential details of the complex negotiations. Normally, Kissinger would have taken his concerns to Haig, but there was little time left, and besides, Kissinger was loath to talk with the general. During the planning for the trip, Haig had been assigned quarters adjacent to the president's suite in the Kremlin Palace. Kissinger, who had wanted them, had registered a bitter protest through Scowcroft. Haig had responded that the White House chief of staff needed to be at the president's side. The battle over the suite lasted several days, and conflicting instructions had gone to the advance team. White House communications agents installed, removed, replaced, removed again, and reinstalled special communications equipment as the prospective occupant changed again and again. Scowcroft could see how short Kissinger's fuse had become. He was drawn and tense, even more snappish than usual. Haig finally won the contest for the room. Technically, the advance staff worked for him. Kissinger, unwilling to expose his interest any further, did not appeal the decision to the president. But his attack on Haig continued. The summit was a diplomatic trip, he told his aides. Why in hell did the chief of staff, nothing but a bureaucrat in essence, have to be close to the president? It was he, not Haig, who was to mastermind the summit strategy. It was he, not Haig, who would keep the president from making a serious error. It was he, not Haig, who would actually conduct the business. When the president finished with his ritual toasts and posing for pictures, Haig knew nothing about the summit. General Haig is out for himself, and when it comes to the crunch, he puts himself first, Kissinger said. At that night's dinner in the Granovitz Hall of the Kremlin, the president used the first exchange of toasts to attribute existing arms agreements to the relationship between Brezhnev and himself. He raised his glass. The agreements, he said, were possible because of a personal relationship that was established between the General Secretary and the President of the United States. And that personal relationship extends to the top officials in both our governments. It has been said that any agreement is only as good as the will of the parties to keep it. Because of our personal relationship, there is no question about our will to keep these agreements and to make more when they are in our mutual interests. The following morning, TASS, the Soviet news agency, translated the president's toast differently. Personal relationship became the relations that have grown up between us, implying that détente was premised on the mutual interests of two nations, not of individuals. Reading the account at breakfast, Robert Kaiser, Moscow correspondent of the Washington Post, noted the distinction. He asked Jerry Warren about it. Warren's jaw seemed to drop, and he hurried to tell Ziegler. That afternoon, Ziegler told reporters that there had simply been a mistake made in translation, and that it would be corrected in the evening editions of Izvestia. He introduced Leonid Zamatyan, director of TASS, who said carefully, General Secretary Brezhnev and President Nixon have repeatedly emphasized the importance of their personal relationship. Ziegler beamed. But the evening's edition repeated the mistranslation, and Soviet sources told selected Moscow correspondents of American newspapers that the distinction was scarcely accidental. As the formal talks went on through the day, the Soviets carried on a game of keeping the president and his staff in the dark about the schedule. Meetings were postponed while Brezhnev napped. Then suddenly a protocol deputy would appear at the entrance to the president's quarters and announce that a meeting was imminent. The pattern continued through the first few sessions. Nixon and his staff were irritated, but they accepted the tactic. The Soviet strategy was to weaken their resolve. The psychological battering continued on Saturday, June 29th. Brezhnev insisted that the president fly with him to his retreat on the Black Sea. Then the trip was delayed, ostensibly because of the weather, then was rescheduled for a later hour. Next, it was moved back to take advantage of a break in the weather, the Russians said. Then it was postponed once more, and minutes later, the Americans were informed that departure would be in half an hour. Brezhnev and Nixon snacked on caviar aboard the Secretary General's Ilyushin 62 airplane. After a 94-minute flight, they drove to Brezhnev's Cliffside Daha in Orléans. Orléans is a district of Yalta, only 3 miles from the center of the larger city. When the Russians had initially suggested Yalta as one of the negotiation sites, the American advance team had objected. They were concerned that Yalta, scene of the historic 1945 meeting of Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill, remained a symbol of an American sellout to the Russians. The advance team referred the question back to Washington, and the president responded that if Brezhnev wanted it, so be it. The Soviets, in turn, agreed to refer to the meeting site as Orléans. Brezhnev escorted the president to the edge of the cliff and then into a plexiglass elevator in which they descended to the beach below. As the two leaders gazed at the sunset, Ziegler remarked how similar the Russian leader's plush vacation spa was to Nixon's San Clemente estate. Next morning, the two men walked down to the beach and its seaside swimming pool. They climbed to the top of the cliff on which the Daha perched, walked through the lush gardens, and admired the lily ponds. Haig, Kissinger, and a retinue of Brezhnev's deputies tagged along. Then, unexpectedly, the president insisted on meeting with Brezhnev alone. The two leaders headed for a meeting room between the main and guest Dahas, while the others waited at the swimming pool. Kissinger had been scheduled to be with the president through all his meetings that day. The negotiations were entering their most crucial phase. He was furious at being excluded. Usually, the president acquitted himself well with Brezhnev, but Nixon still hadn't mastered the briefing book, and Kissinger thought he was no match for Brezhnev, who was always extraordinarily well-briefed. Brezhnev routinely mastered details that the president was accustomed to leaving to his aides. Kissinger worried that the president might make a major slip, get into unfamiliar areas, give something away accidentally. Kissinger was sweating. An hour passed. He paced up and down the length of the swimming pool. An hour and a half. He voiced his concern to his aides. Nixon and Brezhnev had never been alone together for so long. 2 hours. Kissinger could see the two sitting at the pale wood conference table, an assortment of beverages spread on trays next to them. Finally, the others were summoned to the meeting. As the formal talks resumed, it seemed as if the two leaders had not discussed the substance of the negotiations at all. The agenda picked up exactly where it had been, as if nothing had happened. Kissinger and Haig were profoundly troubled. So was everybody else in the presidential party. They had no idea of what the two had discussed. But whatever it was, it became apparent that the president had made no commitments which would compromise the American bargaining strategy. As the talks got more technical, Nixon deferred to Kissinger. Brezhnev continued to conduct the Soviet side of the negotiations, using two Soviet generals as messengers to shuttle in and out with charts of missile strength levels. Then abruptly, Brezhnev announced that there could be no agreement on limiting offensive nuclear weapons. Nothing was possible without greater American concessions, he said. The Americans must allow the Russians a greater number of missiles as compensation for long-range U.S. bombers in Europe and multiple warhead missiles. The president seemed perplexed. Kissinger was stunned. They had expected resistance, but not to this degree. Brezhnev was adopting an extremely hard line. They tried again. Brezhnev could not be moved. The president sat gazing out the windows, looking toward the sea. He desperately wanted some sort of agreement to take back to Washington, but he could not make any further concessions without sacrificing U.S. strategic interests. He had no card left to play. He held firm. That evening, the presidential party had dinner aboard a 115-foot yacht of the Soviet Navy. Nixon and Brezhnev moved aft, drinking as they sailed across the Black Sea, in the shadow of the sheer cliffs of the Yaila Mountains. Brezhnev Wearing sunglasses, Chain smoked Russian cigarettes. The left sleeve of his blue-gray coat slipped above his tanned wrist, exposing an expensive gold watch. The president, dressed in gray slacks and a maroon sports jacket with the customary American flag pin in the lapel, stared out over the water, wistfully at times, a few strands of hair blowing forward across his face. The next day, Brezhnev and Kissinger returned to Moscow, and the president traveled to Minsk. The press plane flying behind the president lost a tire on takeoff and an engine during the flight. The navigator of the Soviet craft walked into the passenger section and poured himself a shot of vodka, then two more to take back to the cockpit. He visited Katyn, where 149 Russians had been forced into a barn and burned alive by Nazi troops on March 22, 1943. He walked through a huge open field, then stopped at the statue of a man carrying his dead child in his arms. He sat down, alone at a small table, and signed the guestbook. The only sounds were the tolling of the memorial bells every 15 seconds and the clicking shutters of the photographers, the press office staff worried about the eerie, lonely image of the president. Nixon returned to Moscow Monday evening and conferred with Kissinger. The Secretary of State had spoken with Brezhnev and had then spent 5 hours bargaining with Foreign Minister Andrei Gremyenko. They had finally worked out an alternative to the seeming impasse on an agreement to limit offensive nuclear weapons. Both sides would sign a protocol committing themselves to eventual negotiation of an agreement that would extend to 1985. It was nothing more than an agreement to agree at some future time. Kissinger usually detested such arrangements. They limited future bargaining options, he felt. But the two sides agreed it was preferable to acknowledge that the momentum of détente had been broken. So they would have this appearance of an agreement, as well as the settlement of two much less important issues, limitations on underground testing and installation of defensive missile systems. The president's disappointment was obvious. He had hoped for far more. He joined Brezhnev later that evening for a final exchange of toasts. Brezhnev remarked that the agreements could probably have been wider. The president re-emphasized the great importance of, variously, his personal relations, his personal friendship, and his personal relationship with Brezhnev. The Soviet leader was unresponsive to the overture. He spoke of the feelings of respect and friendship between the American and Russian peoples. The signing ceremonies took place the next morning. Ziegler struggled to give the summit a public relations coloring beyond its substantive progress, praising the agreements in the hyperbole of history. Throughout the trip, he had been insistent that Kissinger be excluded from the ritual picture-taking sessions. The pictures were to be of the president and Brezhnev. In all but one instance, the photos of the major ceremonies showed the two leaders alone. During the 9.5-hour flight back to the United States, the president worked on a speech, "The process of peace is going steadily forward," to be delivered on live television when he stopped in Maine. From there, he would fly directly to Key Biscayne. He didn't want even to visit Washington. Vice President Ford presided over the televised welcoming in Maine. "I cannot escape the conclusion," he said, "that the biblical injunction, 'Blessed are the peacemakers,' has again been confirmed." Chapter 18. Peter Rodino and his counsel, John Doerr, had taken care to conceal their sentiments and conclusions as the impeachment process went forward. Every public statement and private maneuver was measured to create an illusion of neutrality. It was a necessary pose. They saturated the committee with a catalog of evidence of the crimes by the Nixon White House, all without comment. Their strategy was designed to create a nonpartisan majority for impeachment composed of the committee's 21 Democrats and perhaps half a dozen Republicans. Returning from the hearing room to his office for lunch on June 27th, the chairman was on edge. After 6 weeks of closed hearings, he was under intense pressure to expedite the proceedings. Republicans were charging that the majority was deliberately dragging out the hearings, the Democratic leadership, sensitive to the charge, was growing uneasy. He stopped by a small alcove office where his administrative assistant, Francis O'Brien, sat chatting with three reporters, Sam Donaldson of ABC Television, and Paul Houston and Jack Nelson of the Los Angeles Times. The press had been exceedingly gentle with Rodino, Congressman Everyman from Newark, unpretentious, fair, judicious. How did the chairman think the committee vote was shaping up? Rodino's guard was down, and he said what he thought. All 21 Democrats on the committee would vote to impeach. He hadn't taken a formal count, but he was pretty sure. The 21 votes were sufficient to take impeachment to the floor of the House, but he deemed it essential to pick up at least 5 Republicans and make a strong showing. Nelson, an experienced Washington reporter, had no reason to assume that Rodino's comments were off the record. His front-page story in the next morning's Los Angeles Times said that Rodino had told unnamed visitors in his office that he expected all 21 Democrats to vote to impeach, and it named the 6 Republicans whom Rodino thought most likely to join the majority: William S. Cohen of Maine, Caldwell M. Butler of Virginia, Hamilton Fish, Jr., and Henry P. Smith of New York, and McClory and Railsback of Illinois. The Times account said Rodino had concluded that the evidence was sufficient to justify a Senate trial. It was a background story. Nelson had reported the facts without naming Rodino as a source or quoting him directly. Late the next morning, O'Brien handed the chairman a clipping of the story, and Rodino turned ashen. His offhand comments could destroy his carefully constructed image of impartiality, and with it all hope of bringing Republican votes over. At the White House, Clausen wasted no time. If the Los Angeles Times account was true, he said, Rodino should be dismissed as chairman and replaced by a fair-minded Democrat. Speaker Albert phoned Rodino, urging him to defend himself on the House floor. Rodino went to the floor and told his colleagues, "I want to state unequivocally and categorically that this statement is not true. There is no basis in fact for it, none whatsoever." In that evening's telecast, Sam Donaldson said that he had believed Rodino's estimate to be off the record, but since it had been reported and denied, he felt obliged to confirm the accuracy of Nelson's account. The next day, Clausen described the Judiciary Committee inquiry as a partisan witch hunt, and Father John McLaughlin called Rodino a crude political tactician who ought to disqualify himself. Unnerved by his blunder, Rodino found himself suddenly on the defensive. His credibility with the so-called swing votes, the committee's moderate Republicans and Southern Democrats, strained. Rodino was most concerned about one member of the minority, Thomas Railsback of Moline, Illinois. Railsback was the barometer of impeachment, Rodino believed. He could take 2 to 4 other Republicans with him. An undistinguished legislator, Railsback normally had little influence over his colleagues, but on impeachment, he was genuinely conscience-stricken, and everyone knew it. If Railsback were finally to vote against the president, it could make impeachment acceptable to the J.C.s and Rotarians of America. The impeachment investigation had become all-consuming for Railsback. His evenings were spent discussing the evidence with fellow committee members or listening to the tapes. He had listened so often that he had pinpointed several errors in the text of the committee's transcripts. Railsback shunned the Washington social life as conducted in Georgetown parlors, and so he was surprised when Joseph Alsop, the prominent political columnist, invited him to lunch at his home. Alsop's call sounded almost like a command. Railsback reported on schedule. Alsop traveled in the sophisticated circles that Railsback rarely encountered. A confidant of Kissinger and Haig, he had come to believe the president was 99% nutty as a fruitcake. The armpit of humanity, he called Nixon. But, like Kissinger and Haig, Alsop reeled at the specter of impeachment. He dreaded its effect on the political system, on Kissinger's delicate foreign policy, on the struggle in Indochina. Grievous and permanent national harm would come if a president were routed from office. All presidents stretched the law, he believed, necessarily so. It was Nixon's misfortune to be so personally unappealing that he was being held accountable for it. Impeachment, Alsop told Railsback, would be a catastrophe. It would shake the foundations of a strong presidency. It would be a triumph for the political fringes. The issue was not Richard Nixon, Alsop stressed, but the survival of American strength and tradition. Alsop mocked the prospect of Ford becoming president, the absurdity of a man elected from a single Michigan congressional district, totally without experience in foreign affairs and without any concept of executive authority, occupying the White House. Railsback was surprised at Alsop's undisguised advocacy. It seemed indecent, pompous, even outrageous. Yet he found Alsop fascinating. Alsop invited Railsback back for breakfast, and then for another lunch. At their last meeting, in early July, Railsback secured Alsop's assurance that the conversation would be absolutely confidential and revealed his position. He was not going to vote to impeach Richard Nixon. Alsop thought the Republic was safe. St. Clair's burden was immense. Representing his difficult client in the Supreme Court, defending him before the Judiciary Committee, coordinating each move with the White House public relations machine. In addition, Buzzard had suffered a heart attack in mid-June and was recuperating at home. Buzzard read through the briefs submitted to the court and was appalled at their quality. St. Clair's arguments for withholding the tapes were thin, sometimes amounting to little more than nitpicking. There was no hint of the articulate scholarship that Charles Allen Wright had brought to the first tapes case. St. Clair, who had never argued a case in the Supreme Court, had left much of the work to his even less experienced assistants. Jaworski and Lacavara, on the other hand, had paid careful attention to the preparation of their briefs and their arguments. They had decided to divide the oral argument before the court. Jaworski's presence in court would in itself underscore the momentous nature of the case. Lacavara was more familiar with the legal intricacies. They agreed to remind the court at every opportunity that they represented the government and that Richard Nixon stood before it not as president, but as an individual. They would therefore insist on sitting to the right of the bench, the side reserved for the government. Another matter of protocol presented difficulties for Jaworski. Government attorneys traditionally wear formal cutaways before the Supreme Court, but Jaworski, years ago, had once gone to the court in a borrowed cutaway that didn't fit. He thought he had looked like a penguin, and he wasn't going to repeat his mistake. Lacavara got out a treatise on Supreme Court practice, photocopied the section on attire, and sent it to Jaworski. He got a note back saying, "You should be pleased that I'm not going to show up in cowboy boots and buckskins." On Monday, July 8th, Jaworski wore a dark blue business suit. As the government sedan pulled up to the Supreme Court building just after 9, a cheer went up from the crowd waiting in line to get inside. "Give 'em hell, Leon, baby! And go, Leon!" people shouted. Jaworski, Lacavara, and James Neal had to struggle to get through. Inside, they waited uneasily for about half an hour in the room normally used by the Solicitor General. To break the tension, they speculated about how they would argue to each of the justices in the old paintings that lined the walls. Just before 10, they took their seats at the table to the right of the bench. St. Clair was at the other table. At 2 minutes after 10, the 8 black-robed justices filed in. The jammed courtroom was silent as Chief Justice Berger announced the case. "You may begin whenever you are ready, Mr. Jaworski." Jaworski seemed nervous. He spoke awkwardly as he slowly recited the history of the grand jury's proceedings. He noted that the grand jury had named the president an unindicted co-conspirator. And then he moved haltingly to the heart of the matter. Who is the arbiter of the Constitution? "Now, the president may be right in how he reads the Constitution," Jaworski said. "But he may also be wrong. And if he is wrong, who is there to tell him so? And if there is no one, the president, of course, is free to pursue his course of erroneous interpretations. What then becomes of our constitutional form of government? This nation's constitutional form of government is in serious jeopardy if the president, any president, is to say that the Constitution means what he says it does and that there is no one, not even the Supreme Court, to tell him otherwise. Justice Stewart had some questions on the point. Jaworski summarized the argument. What I am saying is that if he is the sole judge, and he is in error in his interpretation, then he goes on being in error in his interpretation. Then this court will tell him so, Justice Stewart said. That is what this case is about, isn't it? Well, that is what I think the case is about, yes, sir, Jaworski readily agreed. He then challenged St. Clair's basic claim. Under the conditions of his appointment as special prosecutor, the case did not involve an internal dispute within the executive branch. Jaworski cited the assurances of Haig, Bork, and Attorney General William B. Saxby, Richardson's successor, as to his indisputable right to take the president to court on the question of executive privilege. It was up to the court, he said, to decide who was right on the merits. His standing was not at issue. In contrast to Jaworski, St. Clair was affable and relaxed as he began his presentation. He pressed his contention that the court did not have jurisdiction to settle a dispute within the executive branch. Though some powers had been delegated to the special prosecutor, the president was still the president, and the court could not alter that fact. Jaworski was subject to the president's orders and decisions, like any employee of the executive branch. If the court ordered the president to surrender his tapes, they would inevitably make their way to the House Judiciary Committee. That action would involve the court, however indirectly, in an impeachment proceeding, a power the Constitution specifically reserved to Congress. St. Clair was interrupted 217 times by the justices' questions, but their skepticism did not seem to daunt him. They seemed dubious about his claim that executive privilege was absolute and that the president, not the courts, was the ultimate arbiter of what evidence should be surrendered, even in a criminal case. St. Clair insisted that the privilege was essential to protecting the president's privacy, whatever the circumstances. As an example, he cited privileged conversations the president might have about the appointment of a judge. Justice Marshall detected a flaw in that reasoning. Don't you think it would be important if an about-to-be-appointed judge was making a deal with the president for money? Absolutely, St. Clair responded. But by St. Clair's reasoning, Marshall noted, the president would not be obliged to turn over a tape of such a conversation. I would think, St. Clair replied, that that could not be released if it were a confidential communication. If the president did appoint such an individual, the remedy is clear. The remedy is he should be impeached. How are you going to impeach him if you don't know about it? Marshall asked. Well, if you know about it, St. Clair said, then you can state the case. If you don't know about it, you don't have it. So there you are. You're on the prongs of a dilemma, huh? No, I don't think so, St. Clair persisted. Marshall tried to explain. If you know the president is doing something wrong, you can impeach him. But the only way you can find out is this way. You can't impeach him, so you don't impeach him. You lose me someplace along there. The audience broke out into laughter. A few minutes later, Lacavara offered the rebuttal argument on behalf of the United States. He had scarcely begun when Justice White urged him to focus on the matter of executive privilege. Lacavara was delighted. He wanted to emphasize a key point Jaworski had failed to make about the relevancy of Nixon's status as an unindicted co-conspirator. This president is not in a position to claim this public privilege, for the reason that a prima facie case showing can be made that these conversations were not made in pursuance of legitimate governmental processes or the lawful deliberations of the public's business. These conversations, as we showed in our 49-page appendix, and as the grand jury alleged, were in furtherance of a criminal conspiracy to defraud the United States and obstruct justice. As to St. Clair's argument that the court must not be involved in a political dispute, Lacavara cited occasions when the court had decided cases with political implications, beginning with Marbury v. Madison. The court had a duty to interpret the Constitution. That's all we ask for today. That's all Judge Sirica has done. We believe he has done it correctly, and we submit that this court should fully, explicitly, and decisively, he paused, and definitively uphold Judge Sirica's decision. St. Clair did not use his 15 minutes to rebut Lacavara. He conceded that the court often decided cases with political overtones. But this case was different, he argued, in that it would affect the impeachment proceeding. The president is not above the law, nor does he contend that he is. What he does contend is that as president, the law can be applied to him in only one way, and that is by impeachment, not by naming as a co-conspirator in a grand jury indictment, not by indictment or any other way. It was just after 1 p.m. when the arguments concluded. St. Clair came out smiling. He chatted with reporters and signed autographs. "I think it went very well," he said. Jaworski seemed less sanguine, but he smiled to the crowd, acknowledging its cheers. In the prosecutor's press office, James Doyle was getting reports from the other lawyers on the staff. Jaworski had not done a very good job. St. Clair had done better, but Lacavara had rebutted brilliantly. Buzzard received a similar assessment from his sources. St. Clair met with Nixon for 40 minutes that afternoon. It had gone well, he told the president, very well. They had a good chance. He firmly believed it. The president was scheduled to spend the week in Washington, his first full week in the Capitol in 2 months. He had a busy schedule, meetings with cabinet officers, economic advisers, and congressional leaders, and assorted ceremonial occasions. The meetings would demonstrate that the country had a leader who was active in domestic affairs as well as leading the world. Nixon seemed to be reinvigorated by his travels and by St. Clair's assessment. A poll showed that 53% of those questioned thought media coverage of Watergate was excessive. On Tuesday afternoon, July 9th, Rodino shattered the president's show of business as usual. He released the Judiciary Committee's version of 8 tapes. There were awesome differences between what the White House had managed to transcribe and what the committee staff, using superior equipment, was able to hear on the same recordings. To Rodino, the differences demonstrated that the cover-up was still in progress, with the concurrence of Haig and Nixon's lawyers. The staff had prepared a 131-page side-by-side comparison of the texts. Nearly 100 major discrepancies and omissions were noted. The White House editing proved to be predictable. Changes seemed tailored for St. Clair's claim that the president knew nothing of the cover-up until March 21, 1973, and then had acted to end it. According to the White House version of the meeting of March 22, 1973, the president told his aides that John Mitchell was recommending that now we use flexibility in order to get off the cover-up line. The committee transcript said that Nixon quoted Mitchell to the opposite effect, saying that we use flexibility in order to get on with the cover-up. Nixon's order that day to Mitchell, which Haig, St. Clair, and Buzzard had tried to hide from the committee, was also there. I don't give a shit what happens. I want you all to stonewall it. Let them plead the Fifth Amendment, cover up or anything else if it'll save it. Save the plan. That's the whole point. St. Clair tried to justify the omissions and discrepancies. That section had been left out because it was not deemed relevant, he told reporters. It concerned the Senate Watergate Committee and technically did not involve an obstruction of justice since it referred to a congressional, not a Justice Department, investigation. The subpoena had called for a conversation among Nixon, Dean, and Mitchell. The omitted conversation occurred after Dean had apparently left the room, and it was therefore outside the bounds of the subpoena, St. Clair said. What about the other discrepancies? The reporters asked. I would not look upon this as sinister. My experience has been that if you give these tapes to 3 people to listen to, you get 3 variations. Ziegler tried to deflect the impact of the disclosures. He called in reporters from the 2 major wire services and charged that the release was a hyped public relations campaign by Rodino, Dorr, and the Democrats. They have chosen the public relations route, which will focus the news media on only 1 section of the tapes. They should release the full body of evidence altogether, all at once, and not in piecemeal fashion. The headlines in the next morning's editions of the Washington Post, July 10th, read, Transcripts link Nixon to cover-up. At 10 o'clock, the President and Kissinger met in the cabinet room with the congressional leadership of both parties to brief them on the trips to the Middle East and the Soviet Union. Beginning with a long monologue, Nixon observed that his tough posture in the Middle East and with the NATO leaders in Europe had been enough reason to expect a cool reception in Russia. It did not turn out that way. Of the three summits, discussions we had there were the fullest and least belligerent. We made progress, progress that would have been considered monumental 2 years ago, but now, with so much done, it doesn't seem so important, perhaps. He turned to the specifics of the nuclear weapons agreement. Senator Mansfield and Senator Robert E. Byrd, the Democratic whip, appeared to be asleep. Nixon reminisced about earlier summit meetings. In 72, we went out to one of the Dahas, and I sat for 4.5 hours with three Soviet leaders. I took a rough beating on Vietnam, very rough. Brezhnev paced the floor and pounded the table. In 73, I went to bed at 11 p.m. Henry woke me up at 12 and said, "Brezhnev wants to talk." We sat up from 12 to 3:30. This time they gave me a beating on the Mideast. If we had crumbled either time, we would have made no progress overall, but we stood tough. The president glanced around. "For the U.S., the choice we have is either to make an agreement that is adequate for our purposes and for theirs." Kissinger, watching intently, picked up. "One interesting thing which emerged is that they calculate our weapons strength from the perspective of..." Nixon interrupted. "It was a tough discussion, but not one that ended in impasse. They're going back to talk to their people, and we're going back to ours. I talked to Grechko, Andrei Grechko, the Soviet defense minister, and found he was not nearly so lacking in agreement. We can see that they will go balls out."
"Go what?"
inquired Senator Stennis, who was hard of hearing.
"Go balls out! Balls out!" the president said loudly. There were snickers.
"And if so, John, you'll have to vote more money for arms in your committee."
Kissinger mentioned China. "We calculate that by 1978 to 1980, China could be in a position to kill millions of Soviets in any exchange." The president interrupted.
"We believe China would accept the loss of half their population."
"France," Kissinger said. "Pompidou was on so much medication the last year that he couldn't think straight." Kissinger was beginning to dominate the discussion. "One of the biggest problems in East-West relations is excessive talk in the United States of our approaching inferiority. We had to address that question everywhere. Therefore, we have to be concerned that our debate at home does not go overboard." He continued his report, country by country. "Italy." Kissinger told them that the country was in very bad shape. "Forgive me, but dealing with them is like talking to a group of Harvard professors." There was laughter. "You just don't feel like anything will come out of it." "Germany. The new leader, Helmut Schmidt, doesn't suffer from this vapid sentimentality that afflicted Brandt at the end," Kissinger said. "The Russian summit meeting." The key session was Sunday afternoon in the Crimea, where the President and Brezhnev exchanged intelligence estimates.
"If I can be excused for saying so, anyone else would have been arrested for handing out information like that."
The Secretary of State did not mention Brezhnev's refusal to reach any agreement with Nixon. But still the President seemed nervous about where Kissinger's frankness might take the discussion. Nixon offered his own interpretation of Soviet-American relations.
"Why have the Soviets stood aside and allowed us to settle Berlin, Vietnam, and the Middle East? One, because the United States is big, mean, and tough as hell, and they know it. Two, the obsession with peace in the USSR. 20 million Russian people were killed during World War II. We must have the fear elements working, but also the hope element."
That evening, the president entertained 10 conservative congressmen from both parties aboard his yacht. Rain drove them below decks, where Nixon offered another monologue about his trips to the Middle East and Russia. He dwelled on the crowds, especially the ones in Egypt. How friendly they had been, how they cheered as their leaders, Sadat, of course, how the Egyptians were willing to act contrary to what the Russians wanted. That was a relationship to nurture, the friendship with Nasser. This time he did not correct himself, and later he referred again to Nasser. The congressmen glanced at each other uncomfortably. The president rambled on. The Russians were obsessed with peace. He had had to sit through a long Russian movie about the slaughter during World War II.
There was beef tenderloin for dinner. The president had become something of a wine buff during his New York City days, and the Sequoia was stocked with his favorite, a 1966 Chateau Margaux, which sold for about $30 a bottle. He always asked for it when beef was served, and he had issued orders to the stewards about what to do when large groups of congressmen were aboard. His guests were to be served a rather good $6 wine. His glass was to be filled from a bottle of Chateau Margaux, wrapped in a towel.
Trim and well-tanned, John Dean arrived in the Judiciary Committee's hearing room just before 10 o'clock on Thursday, July 11th.
He smiled and shook hands with St. Clair, then took his seat at the witness table. The president's allies had waited a year for an opportunity to question Dean under oath. To the White House, Dean was the tricky, conniving, bottom-dwelling slug, as columnist Joseph Alsop had called him, who had dragged the president into the cover-up. St. Clair was ready. This would be the major Watergate bout, a classic battle between a great cross-examiner and a great witness. During the Army-McCarthy hearings, St. Clair had watched as Joseph Welch destroyed McCarthy in one burst of righteous anger. He hoped for a similar triumph. Dorr was first, and Dean's responses were cool, refined, and detailed. He was in full control of the chronology of events, remembering details as precisely as he had the previous summer at the Senate Watergate Committee hearings. At 2:10 p.m., St. Clair began his questioning. He focused immediately on the linchpin of his defense, that Nixon had not approved the $75,000 payment Howard Hunt received on March 21st. He looked at the committee as he spoke, a technique used by trial lawyers to unnerve a witness and remind the jurors of their duty. In his research, St. Clair had come upon an astounding statement made by Dean to the Senate committee, a statement that, by itself, he was convinced was sufficient to take the president out of the chain of events leading to the $75,000 payment. He picked up the green paperbound volume of Watergate Committee testimony and read from page 1,423. It referred to the president's meeting with Dean on March 21st. Dean had testified, and the money matter was left very much hanging in that meeting. Nothing was resolved. "Do you recall testifying to that?" St. Clair said. "Yes," Dean said, with regard to St. Clair interrupted. "Is that the truth?" he asked sharply. "Yes, it is," Dean replied, "with regard to the raising of $1 million. I didn't think there was anything resolved as to how to raise $1 million. St. Clair had erred. There had been two money issues discussed during that meeting, the possibility of eventually raising $1 million to pay off all the burglars, and Hunt's immediate demand for $120,000, of which $75,000 was paid the same day. Dean had never claimed that the issue of raising $1 million was resolved. But St. Clair, still confused, repeated Dean's quotation from the green volume. "Is that the truth?" he demanded again. "I will stand on my last answer, Mr. St. Clair." Aware that he had turned the point to his advantage, Dean rubbed it in. Until his meeting with the president, he said, he had refused to take part in any decision leading to payment of more money to the burglars. "I had gone in with the intent of trying to turn off the payment to Hunt," he explained. "I came out having been turned around. The president felt it was desirable." The questioning proceeded. Dean continued to demonstrate his superior knowledge and understanding of the record. Several times he corrected St. Clair on dates or names. At one point, St. Clair asked Dean about a question John Mitchell had raised with the president. "Well," Dean corrected, "I testified that Mr. Ehrlichman raised the question. It would be a lot easier if you would just answer yes or no if you could," St. Clair snapped. "You know, time marches." "I understand," said Dean. "Thank you," St. Clair responded coolly, as if he had finally won a point. "But," Dean interjected, "I want the committee to have the full information I have." "I gather that," St. Clair said. "Now just answer the question." Several members of the committee raised objections to St. Clair's manner. He was attempting to browbeat the witness. St. Clair became defensive. "My only point is, Mr. Chairman, that the answers have been very extensive and to a great extent not responsive. but I will not raise the point. I will go ahead. To St. Clair, it seemed ludicrous that a witness as important as Dean would be cross-examined for only half a day. Now he was getting speeches from Dean, but no answers. Dean's a smart little bastard, St. Clair said to himself. But let us endure his speeches, and eventually he'll put his foot in his mouth. The chair asked St. Clair to repeat his question. I must apologize, he said. May it be read? I don't recall the question. Dean was ready. I can save time, he said. I recall the question and the answer I was going to give. Is that satisfactory, Mr. St. Clair? Asked the chairman. Yes, St. Clair answered helplessly. Dean repeated the question and answered it. St. Clair tried to pick up the thread. Did Ehrlichman report the conversation in question to the president on the afternoon of the 21st? That conversation had occurred on the morning of the 22nd, Dean corrected him again, so it would be impossible to report it on the afternoon of the 21st. The question was not terribly important, but St. Clair realized he had been outfoxed. He could only say, I'm sorry, I misspoke. The president's lawyer